Bearing Witness, part of the Racial Reckoning Project, is a reflective dive into the week's events unfolding in this season of racial upheaval and, we hope, change. I'm Anthony Galloway, Executive Director of the Arts Us Center for the African Diaspora.
And I'm Georgia Fort, an independent journalist.
So if you're like me, you've got kiddos at home who ask a lot of questions. And those questions sometimes are with us fully. I can wrap my head around them. And sometimes it's really hard to make sense of the world around us in a way that truly, not just that they understand, but is adequate enough to answer all the questions they have, because a whole lot of stuff around us just don't make any daggone sense. We thought we would be further along the lines in many different areas, and unfortunately, I'm finding myself having to go back to my children and tell them, we haven't really dealt with that yet, or we haven't really turned a corner on that yet. And they're starting to get frustrated. So that's why I'm glad to have somebody like Ms. Georgia I can check in with to say, all right, can you help me make sense of the things that are happening around, at least a little way that I can have a good answer for my kiddo. So Ms. Georgia, what are some of the things that we need to be staying close to and keeping watch over this week as you do your coverage?
Well, I know that most folks right now are watching the election in Minneapolis because, you know, I feel like this election, it symbolizes for some the change, the opportunity for change following the murder of George Floyd. I think this is a huge step for some in a direction to see some tangible change in the policing department. And so I have spoken with folks in community on both sides of this issue, individuals who feel like it's necessary to vote no so that the police can deter violence, as we've seen more violent crimes week after week in the city of Minneapolis. And on the other side of that, I've heard from individuals who feel like the police system in Minneapolis has failed Black residents and it needs to transform into a system of public safety. So I think most people, Anthony, have been following that along with the mayoral election in Minneapolis as well. And so I think that this, it signifies somewhat of a turning point for our city.
You know, there's several questions that are making it to the ballot, not just the one you're referencing around voting yes or no to transitioning to that Office of Public Safety, but also on the ballots in both cities, I believe, is rent control and some of the stabilizing decisions or questions around affordability in this COVID time. So again, there's that space of having to make progress on these issues surrounding policing at the same time as we are still in a pandemic, at the same time as people are still trying to get on their feet as a result of it, at the same time as there are many battles on different fronts. And it's interesting that there's not predictability on who is on the side of voting yes or no. I think this has been an interesting piece looking at those who are weighing in. If you had an assumption about who was on which sides of this vote in terms of supporting as far as community leaders. And so I'm curious, what are some of those surprising perspectives that have, you know, of folks who have come through the mix?
Yeah, I mean, people are on all sides of this issue, specifically on the public safety piece. I mean, we've heard from Janae Bates, who is the communications director for Isaiah, who has been leading Yes for Minneapolis. On the other side of that community debate, we saw Reverend McAfee, who said vote no. We've heard from Dr. Nakima Levy-Armstrong, who I believe is saying that she's voting no. Filmmaker D.A. Bullock, who is vote yes. Sandra Samuels, who is vote no. On the other side of that, you have I believe his name is Jarrell Perry, who's running for mayor, who is vote yes. So, I mean, community leaders are really on all sides of this issue. Chief Arredondo held a press conference saying that, of course, he's encouraging people to vote no. And he addressed a lot of the questions that he's been asked about what would happen to the police department if the vote yes wins. Does it mean that all of the police lose their jobs? Does it mean that, you know, so there's all of these questions, you know, that folks had about what does it mean if a public safety department is what oversees the police department, you know? And I think that there was this misunderstanding that the police department just all of a sudden overnight vanishes. But to your point, Anthony, the issue on policing is one piece of a multi-faceted issue that I think Black, specifically residents in the Twin Cities, have been faced with. I mean, you have these different systems that have really worked against us, and that is how we have arrived at a place where we have all of these disparities. We have disparities in our health system, in our education system, in wealth, quite frankly, home ownership, and the criminal justice system also. But there was this report that came out in the last week. It was an investigation done by Care 11, which showed that Black residents in the Twin Cities are three times more likely to be denied a mortgage, even when they have the same credit score and debt-to-income ratio as white applicants. How do we speak to that? How do we address that? And how do we overcome that barrier so that Black people in the Twin Cities cannot just, you know, be in a community where, yeah, the rent is stabilized, but where we have an equal chance at home ownership and obtaining wealth for the next generation?
You know, I'm so glad you brought that up, because this is a place where many folks who want to raise these issues at necessary tables often face pushback. And that pushback often comes in the sense of well, you know, trying to blame the folks themselves who are experiencing the disservice. And your data, what you just spoke to, and even the data across education, across many other areas, you know, it underscore the fact that for the same circumstance, you know, if it's in terms of our policing, for the same behaviors, we are treated very differently. So you cannot make the argument that somehow one group is more criminal than the other. For the same behaviors, there's disparity, and that's what folks are lifting forward. What you just said on that research, which is backed by many research in many other areas, is that when you take the same exact setup, even the employee name test, which is continually done, you know, by psychology students in different schools for their senior theses over and over again, you have the same thing playing out, that ethnic sounding names don't get called back for interviews, even in some cases having much higher credential in terms of their resumes, let alone, you know, and I know our guests later will be able to speak to this, you know, really well. But in an education system, when every measure that you want to make for parent involvement, whether it be socioeconomic status, language barriers, there are disparities across all of those. And this is something that I don't think folks I don't think is coming into the conversation enough, is that we're not just talking about systemic historical functions. We're talking about, even when those are accounted for and folks are in a position to take full advantage of this quote unquote American dream, that there are disparities and barriers, even when you do all the things right. And I get passionate about this is because somebody said to me at one point that a person is going to need to be Jesus himself in order to move the dial on these unarmed police killings. You couldn't have anybody who's more of an upstanding citizen than Philando Castillo, and he was still killed. And then we had, you know, even in the George Floyd, as you were covering that trial, we had to deal with all of these detractors who were trying to say, well, he should have just done something else, and not focusing on the fact that he never should have died in the first place. So, you know, as you lay the data out, as we make these decisions about policies, you know, going forward, in the back of my mind, I keep coming back to this space is as folks think about these, are they thinking about them from the standpoint of the disparities for the same exact behavior, same exact circumstance, or are some of the folks who are participating in this making decisions based off of these assumptions, these mental models that still put it, that still view Black folks as less human, as more criminal, as less intelligent, and all of these other things that undergird these disparities? These are some of the questions and wonderings that are coming up, just even listening to the data that you put forward.
Yeah, I think that there are, again, people on both sides. I think that there are a number of people in community, Black, white, and even beyond that, who are actively trying to close the gap, right? But on the other side of that, I feel like, you know, just the other day on George Floyd's birthday, I made a post acknowledging what happened to him and where we are, and also how we've kind of started to backslide in some areas. And here come the trolls. I mean, on LinkedIn specifically, I made a post and there were individuals, white men, who were attacking still George Floyd's character, even though the trial has gone before a judge and a jury, and the determination is that he was murdered by Derek Chauvin in the court of law. Regardless of that determination, there are still people in our society, in our community here in the Twin Cities, who do dehumanize George Floyd and only look at him as what his criminal past was. I mean, when you have relatives who have been incarcerated or found guilty of some type of crime, and you understand the motivating factors behind why they were in the situation and why they made the bad decisions that they made, it's a lot easier to humanize a person who has made a couple of bad decisions, right? Maybe for other people who don't have that lived experience, they come from a perfect family. Nobody's ever, you know, been in that kind of situation. Maybe it's a little bit harder. But also, I mean, when we do start to look at the numbers, again, to your point, Anthony, we realize that maybe it's not maybe you have a perfect criminal history, not because you never committed a crime, but because of the color of your skin has allowed you the privilege to have cops that will look the other way, or to have a judge who will give you a warning or a slap on the wrist instead of an actual conviction. Or even if you are convicted, we know when we look at the statistics on sentencing, right? So, you know, I like to remain hopeful and realize that, yeah, there are some people who are working to mitigate these disparities, but we can't be naive and act like they don't exist.
You're listening to Bearing Witness with Anthony and Georgia, created and supported by AMPERS, KMOJ Radio, and the Minnesota Humanities Center, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For our full conversation, please visit racialreckoningmn.org. Our guest today, you know, while we are trying to make sense of this, for me, from a as a pastor in community, you know, in a communal sense, and you as an independent journalist, we've got folks who have to help babies and systems make sense of this in our education sphere. And so I want to bring in our guest. Sharice Ayers is an educator, education scholar, just all around. I consider her, an educational mentor, just in terms of watching in her lead by example and seeing the work and how she treats our babies and helps to build a world for them. I could say a lot, but I want to bring in our guest and get her to weigh in, not only on what she's heard us discuss so far, but also, you know, how it's going for her in community. So Ms. Sharice Ayers, can you come and introduce yourself to the Bearing Witness community? Tell us a little bit about yourself and what's been coming up for you as you've been listening to Georgia and I talk.
Well, first off, thank you for such an an awesome introduction. I'm humbled every time you introduce me, Anthony. But again, my name is Sharice Ayers, and I am a career educator. I've taught middle school and high school for a lot of years, and I'm currently serving as an interim principal of an elementary school in the Twin Cities. I'm also working on a PhD in ed policy and leadership.
Okay. And, I was waiting for you to talk about that educational doctorate, because, you know, I love to call my sisters doctors in this piece.
All right. It's coming.
So what's been coming up for you as you hear some of the issues and the topics that Georgia and I have been talking to so far?
You know, the hard thing about all of this is for our children, they can't process this. And the way that it comes out is often physical. And we have seen an increase in aggression, I would say, in a lot of our students. And that's globally. And so one of the things I tell parents a lot is in kindergarten, you do tend to see more physical aggression. And it is because children do not have all of the language to process what they're experiencing. And so they'll hit or they'll lash out or throw things. And, you know, they throw something that we would call a tantrum. And as students get older and have more words to articulate what they're feeling and have more coping mechanisms, then you see less of that. And so what I've been telling a lot of adults right now is that our world is hurting and our children are a reflection of exactly what's happening in the world. So the things that we're seeing on TV or hearing on the radio or even experiencing, you know, firsthand, those things our children are experiencing too. And they don't have the language, they don't have the capacity to process that. And so it comes out as frustration, it comes out as anger, it comes out as this, again, this physical aggression that's hard to process. And I find it even hard for myself to process. There are times I just turn the radio off. I can't hear anymore. Or it's time to put on Janet Jackson or something. Because I can't do it anymore. And I know that when I come into work, I have to be able to show up and give 100% to our babies. And for me to do that, I have to go to a happy place and be able to hold on to that. And sometimes to just shut out all the things that are going on in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you are working with children, you know, over the last year and a half, 2 years, I feel like on top of the pandemic, all of the protesting and, you know, police killings that we've had in our community, what have been some of those moments that you've shared with students? Could you share anything specific, you know, students who maybe have struggled in processing everything that's happening around them?
Yeah. So just a couple of things. So, and I've been in this principal role for about a month now. And prior to that, I was the supervisor of equity in our school district. And so first I'll talk about things I've seen with, you know, adults even in processing things, because the adults impact the children. You know, if as an adult, if you are happy, healthy, and whole, you're able to impact kids on that level and help them to be happy, healthy, and whole. And so, you know, when the Chauvin trial was happening, you know, and we think about the people that we work with and the people in the community. So actually Derek Chauvin lives within the boundaries of our school district. And so there was a lot of impact of that in dealing with the adults. In terms of the students, there was a student protest and it was a statewide. I think it was a statewide protest. It might've even been a nationwide protest, but I think it was a statewide protest. And a lot of our high school students participated in that. We have two high schools, and one of them for sure showed up, and those high school students showed up in a way where they wanted to have their voices heard about how they were feeling about police violence against Black people. And so I always love and like to lean into opportunities where students are showing up and advocating for themselves. And then think as it relates to our younger students and moments that they've had, not too long ago, there was a tragedy in our community where some children, middle school, high school children, were killed in a car accident that had some involvement with police. And that has had ripple effects throughout our community where so many of the children were connected to other children in other schools. And again, like a lot of our kids don't have words for that to express their pain and express their trauma. And I was actually talking with a colleague a little earlier today, and he was sharing that like a kindergartner talked to him about how she knew this person who, or one of the children who had died in this car accident, and how sad she was about it. And, you know, talking to her about being able to process death and that these things happen and we have friends and we lose them and it makes us feel really bad. And just wondering, like, is that too much for a 5-year-old to handle and to talk about? And, you know, it's a part of our world. It's a part of our lives. And as uncomfortable as it is for us to talk about it and process it, it's important that we open ourselves up to be available to have those conversations and hold space for our babies. And sometimes words don't do. Sometimes we need to hum. Sometimes we need to sing. Sometimes we need to hug it out, which is kind of hard in a pandemic. But there's so many things that we need to do. And that I think that we have space for culturally, that a lot of times we ignore, or don't think it's appropriate, but like really just, you know, and I know you can relate to this, Anthony, just, in the old church, you know, we're singing or we're outlining hymns, or scripture, you know, and giving space for that, that those things are healing, and we have to show our babies how to heal themselves, which means we have to teach ourselves how to heal ourselves too.
You're listening to Bearing Witness with Anthony and Georgia, with special guest Sharice Ayers. Created and supported by AMPERS, KMOJ Radio, and the Minnesota Humanities Center, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For our full conversation, please visit racialreckoningmn.org. I hadn't connected the fact that you were working in the district where those teens were killed in the Chase and Maplewood area. So I know we had talked about that in Georgia. You had covered that pretty closely too. You're the one who broke that news for me. And so I hadn't made that connection, but what you said about, culturally, some of the things that we do and have in place culturally that we ignore. I won't forget. And this story comes to mind just because one of your babies was in the mix. We sat this summer trying to figure out what are some things that we can do. And we kind of devised this scary movie nights where we would just get together and we would watch, we would watch scary movies that parents would okay them to watch. Right. And what I saw happening is in what it was is not the movie night itself. It wasn't the movie part of the night. But there was this moment where the kiddos would sit around the table and they would just begin to bust jokes, at each other and just poke at each other in ways. And not, you know, I was there to make sure that they wasn't going too far, right? Or anything like that. But what was interesting and hilarious is it was like there was this buffer to the world that they knew was out there. And they, you know, we played the dozens. It's a cultural thing, right? And it doesn't, you know, we have some ways, if we're doing it truly, that'll help protect folks from going too far. But we also have some cultural parameters that that help us be resilient to them. And that's just one example. But it's got what you said has got me thinking about the everyday things that we forgot we could do. How many times do we get together and just laugh? I think of that TikTok where there's a group of Black women sitting in a stairwell and it's that challenge where each person has to copy the person in front of them who's saying something. But it gets worse and worse. And you know that the last person in this lineup is the person everybody knows is tone deaf and they can't wait for them to sing it. And it's just a moment of pure joy. We get together and do things like that, or even just making beats on a desk. which was a point of huge issue with a lot of teachers when I was growing up, who the moment they heard anything like that would come and try to stomp it out. And they had no clue that I could either go upside the head of somebody else and do and throw one of the tantrums that you were speaking of earlier and be self-destructive, or I can beat it. I can make a beat on a desk and get it out that way. Right. I think it's a fascinating point that we don't take advantage of the cultural things that we've built to take care of ourselves in this as much as we should.
And you know, you brought up some really interesting points just there as it relates to what it looks like when we take care of ourselves at school. And we talk about identification and representation and how that matters and who are we serving in school and who is being served. Who are we serving and who is doing the service? Who are our teachers are and the disproportionality or the disparities between our teachers and students. And we have lots and lots of white teachers, and our students are increasingly growing in populations of students of color. And so if you as the adult in the room do not recognize beating on a desk as a coping mechanism or as a way of communication, and if you just view it as a distraction, then we have problems. And we talk about some of those disparities that Georgia was mentioning earlier and how they show up in education is with suspension or other discipline, and how, you know, Black students are 8 times more likely to receive discipline than white students, even when you account for all other factors. But again, looking at the needs and being able to recognize different cultures and different cultural practices and how they show up. Our school systems nationwide are very steeped in whiteness, and the ways that we do things and the systems that we have are very steeped in whiteness. Even, you know, from small things like, you know, the idea that a classroom is supposed to be quiet, and that if a classroom is quiet, then that means that work is happening or things are productive. Whereas I always preferred a classroom that was full of life, and I wanted my kids to talk. And there's research that says, you know, the person who's talking the most is learning the most. And so I always wanted my students to talk. And if, you know, beating on the desk is a problem, you have to show the kids, okay, this is when you can beat on the desk. Or how do you incorporate that into your lesson? If you know you've got students who like to get up and move and make music, how do you incorporate that into the work that you're doing to engage them? And that is then healing, you know? And it shows our students that you can show up and be yourself and be an academic and be a scholar. And that scholarly thinking and academic thinking doesn't have to just look one way, that it can look like you and sound like you.
Sister Charisse, future Dr. Charisse Ayers, I'm so glad you joined with us. We're going to end like we always do, and I'm going to kick it to Miss Georgia. Thank you so much for being on Bearing Witness with us today.
In the words of Dr. Joy Lewis, may the revolution be healing.
This is Bearing Witness.
Bearing Witness with Anthony and Georgia is a production of Racial Reckoning, The Arc of Justice, a journalism project created and supported by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, in partnership with KMLJ Radio, the Minnesota Humanities Center, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.